Good morning. I have the privilege of introducing these next four individuals, and I say privilege because I think while many of you know that this community is very fortunate to have these type of leaders in the medical field within our own community. I'm going to do the bios, and it won't be as deserving as they're entitled to, but cut it down because, as you've heard a number of times, we are on a time schedule. But first have Odette Bolano. Odette is the Acting President and Chief Executive Officer of St. Joseph Health System. Ms. Bolano leads over 2,600 team members working in St. Joseph facilities across the Brazos Valley. Prior to joining St. Joseph, Ms. Bolano served as Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of the Carondelet Health Network in Tucson, Arizona. Ms. Bolano has previously worked for the Tenet Health System in Dallas and HCA Healthcare Corporation, where she served for several years as CEO and Conroe Regional Medical Center. As a registered nurse, Ms. Bolano has been involved in all areas of patient care, from staff nurse to chief nursing officer. She received a Bachelor of Science in Nursing from TCU and a Master's in Administration of Healthcare Services from the University of Houston. Ms. Bolano is also fluent in Spanish. Have Dr. William Rayburn. Dr. Rayburn is the CMO of Scott & White in the College Station region. His specialty is OBGY, and he's been serving this local community for 25 years. His patient care emphasis includes hormone replacement therapy, menopausal medicine, reconstructive pelvic surgery. He is a diplomat of the American Board of OBGY and is on the faculty at Texas A&M Health Science Center College of Medicine. There are numerous awards Dr. Rayburn has received through the years, but would like to point out he has been Texas Monthly Super Doctor 7 times. Dr. Rayburn has 2 BS from Texas A&M University, received his MD from Texas A&M Health Science Center College of Medicine in College Station. He served his residency at Scott & White in Temple from 1983 to 1987. His interests and hobbies include gardening, photography, skiing, hunting, fishing, family activities, and sports. We have Tom Jackson, who is the CEO for the College Station Med. Mr. Jackson has been with Med since 1997. He came to College Station from Houston, where he was in healthcare management with Tenet Healthcare and a Methodist hospital. Mr. Jackson brings experience in operations and development and in structuring provider services within managed care. Since joining the Med, he has opened a cardiac cath lab, cancer center, chapel, a new medical office building, and has overseen major additions and renovations to the hospital. Mr. Jackson has a master's degree in healthcare administration from Trinity University and 2 Bachelor of Science degrees from the University of Arkansas. He is active in civic and church activities and serves on many boards and committees within the Bryan College Station area. Tom and his wife Susan, a Texas A&M graduate, have 3 daughters. Last is Dr. Sam Chewmaker, who is the Dean of Medicine and Vice President for the Clinical Affairs of Texas A&M Health Science Center College of Medicine, a position he has held since this past August. Prior to his current position, he served as Professor of Anesthesiology at UTMB and Chancellor's Health Fellow in Healthcare Reform Reimbursement at the University of Texas. From 2006 to 2009, he served as Dean of Austin Programs at the UTMB. Following his graduation from summa cum laude from St. Louis in 1976, Dr. Shoemaker was a legislative intern for Senator John Danforth and then a legislative assistant for Senator Daniel Inouye in Washington, D.C. While completing his law degree from magna cum laude at the Georgetown University School of Law in 79. He's formerly a lieutenant commander in the U.S. Navy Reserve. Excuse me. Dr. Shoemaker has a keen interest in health policy and is the author of more than 3 dozen articles and several book chapters. Since the mid-1990s, Dr. Shoemaker has served on numerous committees of the Association of Medical Colleges. Dr. Shoemaker and his wife, Dr. Suzanne Yandow, a pediatric orthopedic surgeon, have 3 children. So I'm pleased I got through that without too many mistakes, but please join me in welcoming the panel.
Well, good morning. How are you? My name is Odette Bolano, as I was introduced, and several months ago I was asked if I would participate, and I said, sure, and they said, you have 5 to 7 minutes to talk about healthcare. I said, okay. So I'm going to try to get through this, and hopefully there won't be a huge overlap on what we're talking about. As soon as I figure out, Al, don't start that until I figure Here we go. So I don't think that it's anything new to know that, you know, the financial structure of the industry is unsustainable. The healthcare expenditures have tripled since 1960. In the last 10 years, it's gone up by 50%. We've gone from spending $1.3 trillion in healthcare to $2.6. And part of it is that just the baby boomers, the aging population, and the fragmented way that we provide healthcare in our nation. It's outpacing inflation. It's just not sustainable anymore. And we all talk about the waste in the system, you know, $650 billion that are waste on a regular basis. We could have a whole session on that. But that is what we're faced in trying to change. So where is it moving? We all know that prevention and wellness is the mantra of the decade for years to come. We know that healthcare in a hospital is very expensive. We need to continue to move to what we call the medical home and also into the home to provide services for families. But unfortunately, the biggest piece that we have to deal with first is the 5% of our population that spends 50% of the healthcare dollar. We have 15 million chronically ill, poor health, aging Americans that spend about $1.3 trillion of the healthcare dollar. So a lot of the work that's going on today is how do we begin to change the way we deliver care to those very chronic patients and then change the dynamic to wellness and prevention for generations to come. So for you as business leaders and business owners, your big question is how do we deal with this? Our costs continue to go up. What do we do as key members of this community to deal with not only the cost but the wellness and the health of our employee base? And I can tell you that there's a lot out there and there will be a lot more coming about whether you sponsor a health plan, whether you let people go on to the health exchanges that are coming. There's a lot of unknowns because of our governor's stance on whether or not there will be an expansion of the Medicaid program. But I can tell you as business leaders, the really focused areas that you should be looking at is how do you build wellness programs. And Safeway, I was at a seminar not too long ago. I was very, very intrigued by the amount of work that Safeway as a corporation is doing to really incentivize people to take responsibility for their health care. We all know that one of the biggest issues with health care costs is that the cost has been hidden to the end user. And so now we're all shocked about the cost of health care because, in general, nobody really has had to pay much attention to it until now. So what is St. Joseph's focusing on as we move into this new era? We can tell you that we have a pretty strong strategic plan. We'll focus on quality and efficiency. I'll talk a little bit about that. Access close to home is going to be a huge imperative. Physician alignment. Physicians and health systems have been incentivized in very different ways, and now the whole focus is how do you align those incentives. Relationships throughout the continuum. No healthcare system can provide everything to everyone. How do we partner better to make sure that we're making our community strong? Ambulatory services, and then when you need those critical services, that they're there in that community. As you know, St. Joseph's has been a leader in awards and recognitions for the quality of services that they provide and have provided for years to this community. We also have been recognized for the patient experience that we have for those patients and families that come through our doors wherever we're located. This is not a stance that we are there. We will never arrive. It's a journey to continue to meet the expectations of the community and provide the highest quality care. We also know that access, whether it's through mobile, telemedicine, primary care, nurse practitioners, social workers, is going to be where we need to move. And our focus is that we're going to make sure that we're there, convenient, and close to home. As the leader in providing health care for Brazos Valley, we have a very large footprint, and our commitment is to continue to bring those services to the community where they're located, where they live. And so we will have continued expansion in the Brazos Valley of our primary care and clinics, urgent care, and expresses throughout the county. We also know that alignment with our physicians is important, and you've all heard accountable care organizations or ACOs, and if you've seen or read about one, you've seen and only read about one. Everybody is trying to figure out how do they create that integration, what does it look like, how do we work with either employed or non-employed physicians that are really going to be the focus of reducing costs and looking at how do we create the greatest value for the community from quality to cost and convenience. So we have 200 local physicians made up of employed and non-employed physicians that come together in what we call our clinical integration organization to really help us identify how do we provide healthcare differently and go out to employers and work with our payers to provide them that product. Relationships through the continuum. Even though we have two nursing homes and we have urgent cares and all different kinds of services that we provide, there are many other people out there that we need to learn how to partner. Even people here at the table, we need to make sure that we're doing the right thing for the community. So how do we work with school nurses? How do we work with other long-term care, hospice, nursing, in order to make sure that everybody's focused on the quality of care that we provide and not incentivized by providing just episodic care for a chronic disease. Focus and collaboration with our physicians across the entire county is also going to be a very important focus for us. When we look at hospitals, we know that in the future, it's not where healthcare is going to be provided. And so how do we create in the community where we can provide urgent care, primary care, community wellness and education, diagnostic services, all there in order for the patient to, you know, just like Walgreens and CVS, you got to be on every corner to make sure that you're providing the care as conveniently as possible for the community. And while we all focus on wellness and prevention, we know that the most critical piece is that we have the most elaborate care for very critical areas. So trauma designation, trauma level 2 designation for St. Joseph's is an imperative. We have committed to this community that when you need those critical services, they will be here right at home. We've invested quite a bit to make sure that we maintain this promise for you. So what's happening in healthcare just in general? What I can tell you is if we look at other industries, healthcare has been slow to compete on value. And now that is what we are having to compete on. We also know that changes are not going to be smooth nor linear. We're going to have to learn together. We're going to make a lot of mistakes in the healthcare arena as we continue to get to that end goal. There's also going to be cross-industry competition, healthcare systems versus retail versus technology is really going to change the dynamic of what we call healthcare in 2020, and it's going to change the value proposition. Consumers have constantly been passive in the way that they obtain their healthcare. So employers are getting more and more savvy about creating incentives. Retail access and new technology will really create engagement for the consumer, demand more information, and really push for value. And the metamorphosis of just a supply and demand kind of industry will be driven by demand that will happen quickly and erratically throughout the entire nation. There's a lot of statistics that say by 2020, 50% of the hospitals across the nation will close. And if you look at countries like Denmark, when they went from sick care to preventive and wellness, 70% of their hospitals closed. And that wasn't that you needed less people and less services. That meant that you needed to get the services out to the community at the lowest cost in the most convenient way. So that is where we're headed. I do want to share something with you. There's a lot out there that's already happening. I'd like to read this excerpt from you of what they predict will be happening by 2018, which really isn't that far off. Expect viral health innovation adoption curves. Imagine holding a mobile device up to your child's ear and transmitting the relevant biometric information to the retail health cloud for an immediate diagnosis and treatment plan. Imagine a $100 saliva-based genomic sequencing test at a walk-up kiosk available in 50,000 retail health stores, along with a personalized health plan and a mobile app to help navigate your personal health profile. The industry is ready and on pace to deliver. Will we be ready to understand and manage the implications of our personalized genomic sequence? I have to tell you a quick little story. I have a son who is at Vanderbilt in medical school. He's in third year. 3 months ago, he called me and he said, "Hey, I just had a blood test." I said, "Really? For what?" And he says, "Genomic testing." I said, "Wow, what are you doing with that?" He said, "I got my results. I know what I am. I'm deep. That I am. What was it that he said? That he is. His genetic makeup has put out there for him to be predisposed for." And he says, "I'm studying that, and I know now how to change my lifestyle to make sure that I can live a healthier lifestyle." And then the other thing that he said to me is, "You know, in the next few months, I've applied to for a grant at Wake Forest where they're growing organs. And I'm going there to make sure that I'm part of that." So it's a whole new era. Healthcare will be very, very different. It will be in the hands of the consumer and not of the healthcare provider in the future. Thank you.
Howdy. My name's Tom Jackson. It's my pleasure to visit with you today. I don't think I have slides for you, but I do have some thoughts. This is an exciting time in healthcare. I think Odette said it best. I think we've never seen changes like we've seen today. I will tell you, growing up in this profession, my parents were in the medical profession in a small community in central Arkansas. This is as most change that we've seen since the introduction of Medicare. I think when I listened to my parents' stories of Medicare, I don't think they realized how it was going to impact their practice. I remember the stories, and I remember how they had to change their lifestyles to make it happen. They were not excited about it. They were not encouraged by it. My mom actually changed professions to help get through it. And for 45 years, that's what they provided. And they rolled with the flow. They provided services to people. And they did it with eloquence, and they did it with a lot of grace. And I think today, when you look at the changes that are going on in healthcare, we're at the same time we were when LBJ introduced the Great Society to America. I think we're going to expand care. I think we'll do it a little bit quicker than we probably should, but I think it's an exciting time in healthcare. All of us in this industry want to serve people. That's why we got into it. To me, this has always been one of the most dynamic service industries that anybody could be in. It's what attracted me to it, and I think that's what continues probably for everybody that's speaking today on this topic, drives them to do what they do. It's a stressful business. It's an opportunity to serve people business. And to me, as I've been here a number of years now, I've listened to really smart people that I admire, and one I'm going to talk about today is Lynn Berry. For whatever reason, Lynn Berry took an interest in me a few years ago, and I've listened to him, and I've talked to him, and I've sought his counsel. And if you don't know Lynn Berry, he's one of many treasures that we have at Texas A&M University. Dr. Berry is not only a distinguished professor, but he's a recognized leader in healthcare, and he's devoted his career to this. And he's talked to me at length about the term of relevancy. And what does relevancy mean when you're sick, and what does it mean when you're well? And what does it mean to collaborate with people, and what does it mean to sort of put other people together to make something bigger than what you could do on your own? And that's where the genesis of our 30-minute campaign to see people in the ER came from, was Lynn Berry talking to me about relevancy when people are sick. About 8 years ago, I met Eric Wilkie, a very well-known emergency medicine doctor, and we started dreaming about, could we make a difference? Could we be relevant when people are sick, when they need emergency care? Eric changed the lifestyle for us when it came to emergency medicine. He certainly changed it for this region, and there birthed a commitment to be seen by a board-certified ER doctor in 30 minutes. It's now become an industry standard in a lot of areas of the country. It's actually within our 135 hospitals within community health systems an expectation that everybody will have a 30-minute commitment. Last year we saw 30,000 visits and we averaged 17 minutes to be seen by a board-certified ER doctor. I took that concept to our cardiologist and I asked them if they could follow the same theme that Eric did and Dr. Barry introduced and do the same thing for cardiology. Could you resolve a heart attack or myocardial infarction when you come to the ER within 60 minutes? Now the national standard says 90 minutes. That's what the expectations are. So we lowered it to 60. Last year we averaged 42 minutes. So it's those kind of things and ideas that came here locally that drives us to try to be the best we can be. Relevancy is a big issue for us. It's a big issue for me. It's one that pushes us to do more than we would normally do. And I think it's what's really made the developments on Rock Prairie, the medical district, and the things that are happening on the south end of College Station so very exciting. When I met Larry Isham and Kathy Langlotz, I presented the concept that originally came from Lynn Berry about relevancy when people are well. Odette mentioned wellness. It's what I think is the biggest single missed opportunity in the Affordable Care Act. If you're a business leader, you need to get in the business of the health of your employees. Lynn Berry has written about this extensively. Some employers are doing that. Most people are not. People need to know that there's opportunities for incentives to stay well. And if you stay well, you should, quite frankly, pay less health insurance than you do if you lead a reckless lifestyle and you don't manage your health. Now, I'm not talking about the outliers. I'm talking about the normal people that walk daily lives that are trying to stay well. Dr. Barry's talked about that. There are a lot of companies that have done it. And that's what led us to taking about 3 acres of land and doing an enormously progressive project, about $8.5 million worth of 40,000 square feet that's going to be on the corner of Longmire and Rock Prairie with AeroFit. And it'll change the way people look at health and wellness. It'll be the first time that you as an employer can come to us and actually have your employees join a health facility, and if they want to, have a cloud and a USB drive that actually stays on your belt, that monitors what you do, that ties in your health risk assessment, which will be in that cloud, and you can send that to your doctor. Doesn't have to be our doctor, you can send it to any doctor. But you can take that information at the end of the year and go to your employer and say, I'm doing something about my health, and I want to be incentivized by it. There are some employers that are self-funded that actually can do something with their insurance underwriter. Brian Brown's one of many people in this community that know a lot about this topic more than me. But it's, to me, one of those opportunities in healthcare that can change the way we do things. And lastly, the medical district for me in College Station is something that I've seen over a number of years. As you saw earlier from the bioscience corridor on the 47 campus and the great developments that have occurred in Bryan, this is a really nice opportunity for this region to have a destination point. It's no different than the Post Oak Mall area, the Texas Medical Center, the Woodlands Mall, or the Downtown Arts District in Dallas or Houston. It's economic in density, and it's making an area of the community better than what it would be on its own. It's got an enormous opportunity for the city of College Station and for our region, and it's got an enormous opportunity for those of us that are out there. So to me, it's a reflection of what Lynn Berry said early on. This is a great opportunity in healthcare to do things that are above average, that push us to do more than we could do normally, and to really, for me, bring relevancy home when you're sick and when you're well. So it's my pleasure to be here, and I look forward to any questions you might have about that or anything else that I might be able to answer about healthcare. Thank you.
Howdy. I'm Bill Rayburn. I'm an OB-GYN physician at Scott & White. Aggie, class 1979, 1981, 1983. I had to go several times to get done. I was in the third medical school class here at Texas A&M. I can't tell you how important the College of Medicine is to me personally, and the incredible indebtedness that I have to Texas A&M University and the College of Medicine for taking a chance and letting somebody in as an alternate into their medical school. I'm an OB-GYN. Somebody asked me the other day, how many babies have you delivered? And I said, I have no earthly idea, but I decided I would go back and count. I actually did it. I've delivered 2,200 babies in this community. I quit delivering about 2 years ago. I continue to do GYN and GYN surgery. And I think that Odette and Tom have touched upon the transformational nature of what's going on in our industry. But what I'd like to do is, other than completely agree with their comments, is to maybe give you the perspective a little bit of a clinician, a physician, a provider, and how our world is changing, and I would pose to you changing for the better. Scott and White came here in 1985, two physicians. 1986, 20 physicians. 1999, 60 physicians. 1999 is when I took over as the medical director of the College Station Clinic. In 2009, we acquired the Brenham Hospital. We began a group practice in Brenham. In 2010, we opened the Arrington Road Clinic. In 2013, obviously, we will be opening a facility at the corner of Rock Prairie and 6. We will also be opening a facility in Bryan, right next to IHOP, on the Boonville exit. And obviously, the acquisition of the 98 acres at the corner of Rock Prairie is clearly been a pretty big deal in the community. By the time a year from now, we will have approximately 150 employed physicians. Our hospital will be an open staff hospital. There'll be non-Scott and White employed physicians working out of our hospital. And we will cover the broad spectrum of care services like the Med and St. Joseph. And you're not going to hear me say a single negative comment about the Med or St. Joe. These are fine facilities in our community. Our community is blessed to have multiple good providers. And I think Tom and Odette would agree with me that when you raise the bar of competition, guess who benefits? You, the consumer. Every one of us are keenly aware that patients need to be seen promptly and that access is the key to good care. So I do believe competition is good for all of us. The cost of care, as Odette said, is unsustainable. We really have not held the healthcare industry accountable for the product that they've delivered, and that's changing. And so the industry of healthcare is transforming. I would pose to you the transformation is probably, for the majority, is occurring at the finance side. And the delivery is far, far behind the reform in finance. We're moving away from treating disease. We're moving away from being paid for every widget that we produce. And we are being incentivized by the payers for good outcomes. And the payers will incentivize, by their definition of quality, how we will be paid. Now, that's a macro concept, but at a micro level, think about your own life. How do you view healthcare? My wife is currently being treated for breast cancer, and I will tell you that it's changed the way I look at it. Suddenly, it's a very private situation, and we cannot allow the transformation and this value that needs to be driven through healthcare to override the very personal nature of healthcare delivery. I honestly don't believe we're going to be putting cell phones up to our kids' ears and be getting prescriptions sent in without an evaluation. I could be wrong, but I bet not. In 1987, when I started here, we were told the days of managed care were upon us, and we were told there were too many hospital beds, there were too many physicians, and that there would be a problem in healthcare in the future. Now let's fast forward. There is a physician shortage. There continues to be the need for inpatient beds. I do agree with Odette. If transformation occurs the way they describe it, there may be a need for less beds, but let's not forget the demographics of our society. The baby boomers are getting old all at the same time. And not all of us had the best lifestyles during the 60s and 70s. It's probably going to come back to haunt us. I'm speaking, of course, my friends up here, not me. But the reality is that a huge population is occurring that is moving into the Medicare age, and there will continue to be utilization of services. Scott White is the forefront, is at the forefront of healthcare delivery transformation. We have an integrated model. You'll hear the term. But unlike the other healthcare systems, most of our physicians are employed, and they work for me. And we set the goals, we set the expectations, we set what we expect in patient satisfaction, we set the expectations with regard to productivity. We want to control the continuum of care. When my mother was admitted to Memorial Hermann in Houston over Christmas last year, she saw 16 different physicians over a period of 5 days. 16 different physicians. Every day a different hospitalist. Every day a different cardiologist. Every day a different hematologist. It's unacceptable. That's where the waste in care is. There has to be better continuity and integration in the delivery of that care. And that speaks volumes regarding the need for an electronic platform between a physician's office and a hospital, and in health information exchanges so that the Med, St. Joseph, Scott and White can share medical information when a patient presents to their hospitals. Scott and White is a pioneer in electronic medical records. We had an electronic medical record 18 years ago. We have been recognized by CMS, Medicare, as one of the low-cost providers in the United States. Medicare has awarded Scott and White. We do have an ACO, actually. Scott and White has partnered with Walgreens nationally for an accountable care organization. Scott and White has partnered with Walmart nationally. Back surgeries, heart surgeries throughout the United States will come to one of six centers of excellence, Scott and White being one of them. And I'm extremely proud of our relationship with SAM and the College of Medicine. St. Joseph and the Med also have strong partnerships with the College of Medicine, and together we all feel an equal responsibility to teach tomorrow's physician. Of course, we've heard about Scott and White's intent to merge with Baylor, so let me go ahead and address that before it comes up in the question and answer session. Scott and White's a $2.2 billion organization. Baylor is a $5 billion organization. Baylor approached Scott and White 3 years ago. They were interested in our integrated model. They were interested in our insurance product. But they were mostly interested in how in the world do you have an organization where physicians are leading and you have physician leaders. To make a long story short, we believe that a merger with Baylor, I'm a member of the Board of Trustees, will make us a stronger organization. Scott and White Healthcare will continue to operate just as it always has, but we will be a much larger organization and much more influential in the state of Texas. So I'd like to finish with maybe a story. Dream with me for a minute. Patient comes to the hospital. They have congestive heart failure. They're admitted in the emergency department. The emergency department physician uses the same electronic medical record as the physician's office. The patient's in the hospital. The patient is processed through evidence types of care that have been shown to bring value to the payer. The patient is discharged. Imagine a patient leaving a hospital with their medicines. Isn't that amazing? Isn't it amazing that we send patients home from the hospital with prescriptions and ask them to go fill the prescriptions as they're leaving a hospital? Imagine that they leave the hospital, they have the appointment, and all of that is integrated in the same model. So we're going to focus on the continuum of care. We're going to focus on trying to bring more value, but I don't believe for a minute that we can commoditize healthcare and that we can simply make it a standard way of doing it. It is a unique individual experience. It's a human experience, and it's mostly between humans. And I'd like to leave you with a quick story. A friend of mine's a vet here in town, and he told me that he was very concerned about the cost of health care. And I explained to him I was very concerned about the cost of the care at the vet. And he relayed the story to me where the lady brought the parrot in. The parrot was dead. The lady was beside herself, upset that the parrot, her bird, had died. She says, "You got to do something." He shook the parrot. You know, parrot's dead. She just starts wailing and says, "You've got to do something." So he whistles. The Labrador retriever runs in, jumps up on a table, sniffs. The lab retriever looks at the vet, just goes. The vet looks at the lady, she just starts wailing. He says, "We've got to do something." And he whistles, and a cat comes running in. The cat jumps up on the table, sniffs this obviously dead bird. Cat looks at the vet. Vet looks at the lady. She's just wailing. He escorts her out. She checks out, and there's a bill for $400. And she just goes ballistic, and she says, $400, I don't understand. He says, "Well, my part was only $100, but the cat skin and the lab work was the additional $300. Thank you.
Howdy. So I move pretty well for somebody that was born in the 1700s, right? You know, it's that genomic medicine that Odette was talking about, and plastic surgery, lots of plastic surgery. Anyway, it's a pleasure to be here this morning. I really appreciate the opportunity, and it's great to share the stage with colleagues who I have a great deal of respect for. We are living in a time of incredible change in medicine, and I'm going to describe what that looks like from the perspective of the Texas A&M Health Science Center. Now, the Health Science Center was founded back in 1999 as essentially the health science university for the Texas A&M system. It's comprised of six colleges, and we're spread all over the state. So we have campuses in Dallas, all the way down to McAllen, from Round Rock, all the way east to Houston. We're in about 100 counties of the state. We're probably the most widely dispersed health science center of any in the entire United States. One of the big things that's happening in our world is that we are being reintegrated back into Texas A&M University. And we're not exactly sure what that's going to look like at the end of the day. It's supposed to happen next summer. But we do believe it will provide additional opportunities for us to collaborate in research programs and education that will create synergy and create a stronger university all around. You might say, well, what is an academic health center? Well, an academic health center has multiple missions. Not only do we do clinical patient care and community service, but our main missions are really education, so we train the next generation of healthcare providers, and we do biomedical research. Right now, our Health Science Center has about 500 full-time faculty and about 1,000 staff on the payroll. We have 2,300 students enrolled in various programs in our Health Science Center. And we have about a $1.3 billion economic impact on the state of Texas, including about $300 million in direct expenditures that we make as a health science center. And that includes about almost $100 million in research. So one of the major priorities that our chancellor has is to grow that research and to make Texas A&M a more substantial and more diverse research university. Our College of Nursing was established back in 2008. It's primarily based here in Bryan College Station, but they also have some students in Round Rock. We have a School of Public Health. It's called the School of Rural Public Health. And so it's a unique public health program because it focuses on the needs of the rural parts of the state of Texas. That's located here in Bryan College Station. It was established back in 1995. We have a College of Pharmacy, and it's down in Kingsville. So it is the only health profession school located south of San Antonio, and it's really set up to serve the people of South Texas. It has one of the most diverse student bodies of any College of Pharmacy in the United States, and it started back in 2006. Our College of Dentistry is located in Dallas. So it is the oldest college of dentistry in the state of Texas, and has the most diverse student body of any dental school in Texas. It joined the Texas A&M University system back in 1996 and then joined the Health Science Center in 1999. Our College of Medicine, which is the unit that I'm most familiar with, was started in 1977. And we started in the basement of the Teague Building on main campus with 32 students. And we now have 200 students per class. So we have grown phenomenally over the course of our history. We have 140 full-time faculty, but we have over 2,000 part-time and volunteer faculty. So we use practicing doctors in communities across the state to educate our medical students. And we are a medical school that relies on partnerships. And as Bill was alluding to earlier, we have strong partnerships with the College Station Medical Center, with St. Joe's, and with Scott and White in this community. All of their doctors participate in teaching our students. We think that model works very, very well. So we are a education is kind of a neutral pastime for all the health systems that they can agree on and not worry about competition. We have campuses in Dallas, Round Rock, here in Bryan College Station, and in Temple. So we use all four campuses to educate our medical students. Over 85% of our graduates are practicing in the state of Texas, which I'm very proud of. So our College of Medicine is a very good investment for the state. We focus on training primary care doctors because that's what we think the state needs. And over 50% of our graduates go into primary care specialties. And there are people like Bill Rayburn who are making a difference in their communities all across this state. And that's what a public medical school should aspire to do, and that's what we do. I'll speak just briefly about some research trends that I'm seeing. Research these days has become a team sport. So the more collaborators you can bring together to float new ideas and create new partnerships, the better you seem to do. And so that's what we're about. We're looking for partnerships across the Health Science Center and across the university. You may have heard the term One Health. One Health is a unique opportunity for us because we are one of the only universities in the United States that has veterinary medicine, human medicine, and public health co-located with one another. So One Health is a collaborative effort of multiple disciplines to try to improve optimal health, or to improve health for animals, humans, and our environment. And it's become a real research focus for Texas A&M University, and it's an area in which we feel we can make a very significant national contribution. I'm just going to end with a few of the challenges that we're facing today so you have a sense of the issues that we deal with on a day-to-day basis. We are, like everybody else in the healthcare industry, facing resource constraints in providing a quality education and providing quality research programs with limited resources is always a challenge. I'm very concerned about the level of NIH funding, for example. That doesn't seem like there are many prospects for any substantial increase in NIH funding anytime soon, and we rely heavily on NIH funding to support our research program. So what are we doing? We're turning to industry partnerships and looking for other ways to help support our scientists as they do their important work. We are really committed to try to help communities improve the healthcare outcomes of their citizens, and that's so we're trying very, very hard to reach out to communities all across the state. We're trying to train a workforce that resembles the population that it serves and meets the state's need for physicians. As Bill has alluded to, the state is facing a very significant physician shortage in virtually every specialty, but we are doing our best to help meet the needs of our state for more physicians. So we're really interested in diversity and primary care as two important institutional priorities for our college. And then finally, this is kind of a wild card, but the advent of technology in higher education has become a real disruptive innovation, and we are going to have to think very carefully and very strategically about how we position ourselves to both take advantage of the opportunities but also respond to the threats that that might pose to us. So thanks so much for allowing me to share a few thoughts.
This lady had a sick parrot. She took it to the vet. The vet said, I've got good news and bad news. The bad news is your parrot has chirpies. The good news is it's very tweetable. Yeah, thank you. That man has got guts to stand in front of this crowd. We have about 10 minutes for questions, and we have a few that have been tweeted into us. The first one that we got was for Scott and White. It was, how many employees total do you think you'll have, and when are you going to start hiring, and how do you think this is going to affect the hiring policies at the other clinics and hospitals?
Well, our hospital will open August 1st. We've already began hiring director-level positions. We will hire probably 400 folks. We will bring 50 additional physicians. I think the number that's been quoted as far as economic impact for the community is approximately $40 million in new salaries over the next 5 to 7 years. We will begin an aggressive recruitment and hiring process starting about mid-March. In all our intelligence, we've decided to not only open a hospital on August 1st, but to go live with our electronic medical record Epic on that same day. So we're really looking forward to getting past August 1st.
Tom, this was sent to you, and we also had the similar question was sent to all panelists, so since that puts you one ahead of everybody else, we'll start with you. Right. When will the hospital start sharing patient records and info?
Well, electronic medical records is an initiative that was set forth by all hospitals in the country during the first term of our current president. So we're all mandated to have an electronic medical record, what we call meaningful use expectations, and so we're in line with that as well as everyone else at this panel. Electronic order entry on the floors, the process that Dr. Rayburn's talking about they'll do, is underway at our facility as well. Most of our hospital is fully digital now. As far as sharing records, I think the compliance issues about that and about the local community health network and opportunities to do that, I think, is something that each community will work out on their own. But as far as the electronic medium of health records, it's not only a mandated expectation, but it's well along in our facility as well as it is in everybody else's across the country. So
you deal with probably more regulation, government regulation, than any other industry, almost. I mean, none of us in here are generating none of us are digging coal right now, but if you had it where you could just say, okay, I'd like for this one to go away, this one holds me back worse than anything else in providing care to people, what would it be?
Well, I think for me, the initiation of opportunities for people to be incentivized to stay well, and the simplicity of that would be where I would fundamentally like to see this industry change. There are some regulations that bother me that seem to be overly aggressive. Somebody asked me earlier today in the audience, I was in your hospital last week, and I actually said, honestly, I tried not to look because there's so many laws about who's in the hospital and what you can share because of the awareness of the HIPAA regulations that started a few years ago. That was initiated to be able to allow an employee to transfer their insurance from one employer to the next, to be able to have it portable. That was a good thing. It's a good thing that if you don't have a pre-existing condition, you can continue to do that. Probably bad about all the HIPAA, the PUH side of that, because we've become so aggressive in that bureaucratically that we're almost paralyzed for that. But the big issue in this industry that's missing is the incentives to stay compliant with your risks. We all have health risks, to know what they are, to get with your doctor, and to be able to go to your employer, or if you're self-funded, or if you've got insurance through Medicare or another source, and be able to say, this is what I'm doing to stay healthy. It seems to be a real missed opportunity. I know business leaders across the country that I speak to here locally are yearning for that, and I think that's probably the thing that I would change, Ben, if I could change anything. More focus on rewarding individuals to stay accountable to their health, and you would see healthcare costs drop immediately, because Americans by nature are very competitive people. That's not what we're doing today, and that's the single one thing that I would change.
Well, Dad, I have a hard question for you, but first I wanted to ask Dr. Shoemaker. We've talked about a shortage of physicians. Is it possible that we need a different level of medical care? Does it really require 8 or 10 years of medical school to write a script for a Z-Pak?
It's a good question. I think the answer to the access to care problem that we're going to face as a result of the Affordable Care Act is having multiple health professions working at the upper limit of their training and certification. So the name of the game these days is team-based care in healthcare settings. So we need more physicians, but we also need more nurses, we need more pharmacists, we need more social workers. And using that team approach, it's possible to take care of a larger number of patients than individual health providers can care for individually. The question of how long it takes to complete medical school has been debated back and forth for many years. The Europeans do it differently. They have a 6-year medical curriculum where a student will get both an undergraduate degree and a medical degree at the conclusion of 6 years. There are pilot programs in some states that are exploring that option. There are also there's a pilot program going on here at Texas Tech where they are putting a cohort of students through a 3-year program. So there are attempts to shorten the training. But there's an awful lot to learn, and so you don't want to cut down the time to train at the expense of increasing mistakes or producing practitioners that aren't as competent as they need to be.
Well, Dad, you mentioned your son had his genomic test done and knows his predispositions toward disease and how things will turn out. Those of us who still read magazines, Time Magazine raised a lot of issues about that in issue a couple of weeks ago. One of the things is that if a physician discovers that a child, through doing genomic testing, is going to be predisposed with a level of certainty, so I know predisposition is not outcome, but in some cases it's pretty close. But if they found that a child was going to be predisposed to early onset Alzheimer's, they made the decision, we're not going to say anything about it. If we go to, it would be unethical to doom that parent and change their the way they looked at their children, and more importantly, the way insurance looks at that person as they become an adult. If we go to $100 saliva swabs, how are we going to address that, both from an insurance and from a moral and ethical standpoint? It might be a case where somebody would say, this person has a predisposition to cancer. There's no need for us to treat this because something else is going to get them first. How are we going to do that when we have this predictive tool in our toolkit?
Bad story to share, huh? So I would say that one of the biggest issues in healthcare is the amount of information, and people today are walking into their physicians' offices, doing their Google searches, and coming in and talking about what they think they need or what how they feel should they should be treated. I think that the more information that people have in their hands to be able to manage their care and prevention and wellness is going to be critical in tomorrow's future. I think that there is a lot of ethical questions as far as what we learn and what we are able to, as a society, gain from technology advancements. Today, you know, predisposition has been taken off the table. Insurance can no longer hold back insurance because somebody has a pre-existing condition. And so hopefully as a society we will continue to assure that we're taking care of our communities in an appropriate manner. And there will be a lot of ethical issues that come up as we become more technologically savvy, and there's industry out there that can tell us a lot more. There's a lot of discussion right now about whether women should have mammography every year. You know, are we over-treating certain diseases that the outcome would truly not be any different? So I think that there's a lot of work to be done there.
Don't go away. There's one that was addressed specifically to you that I thought I would save because it is a breath intaker. It's one of those that goes this way. How do you prevent redundancy? How many neurosurgeons do we need in Bryan College Station? If we're going to have overlapping services, are we going to be checking a surgeon's outcomes before we pick a hospital?
So, good question. I think that as a healthcare provider and my partners up here on stage, that's something that we are constantly looking at. How do we make sure that we're not oversaturating the market, making it more difficult, and actually increasing the cost of care just because you have more providers? I don't think that there's an easy answer to that question. Bill and I have met and talked a little bit about that. When you have very high-end, very expensive services that overlap may be created, and how do we make sure that we keep the cost of care down for a community? So more to come on that.
Would you are you saying then perhaps that Bill works on does things for one particular high-end specialty and St. Joseph's and the Med specialize in another high-end specialty, or does everybody have a neurosurgery department?
Thank you.
I don't think we can.
Third microphone. I think you're there. Nope. You're off. Now it's off.
I think St. Joe cut me off. Just teasing, Odette. There's no way that three hospital systems can survive in this community with three neurosurgical programs, three cardiovascular surgical programs, three neonatal intensive care units. It just won't work. So we will have to work together. We will have to be intelligent in the way that we share resources. The College of Medicine can be a valuable part of that partnership. The good news is that Odette and Tom and I like each other, we respect each other, and we know the future is going to be to provide care for less money. And so we better work together if we're going to survive.
Dr. Shoemaker, will A&M ever start a physician or assistant physical therapist program? A physician's assistant, sorry, or physical therapist program?
I can't make a prediction that would guarantee any particular result at this point, but we have had some discussions about a PA program, and I don't know where that'll go. Starting new healthcare programs is typically a fairly expensive venture. It requires a lot of capitalization in terms of new faculty, new facilities, that kind of thing. So it's not a venture that we would enter into lightly.
Well, thank you all very much for being with us. I think you all deserve a round of applause for answering the mean questions.